Welcome to the Core Principles Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll enjoy this lively discussion of relevant topics, which we attempt to examine through the lens of unchanging, objective truth. Here is the host of the Core Principles Podcast, Clay Howerton.
Thank you, Suzanne. Today on Core Principles, I am honored to welcome a truly extraordinary man. He is the founder of the National Post, and through his controlling interest in London's Telegraph Group and ownership of the Jerusalem Post, his companies once ran over 400 newspapers. He's been a talk show host in Canada, as which he interviewed men who would become Prime Minister of Canada, Prime Minister of Britain, and President of the United States, his friend Donald John Trump. In 2001, late Queen Elizabeth II conferred on this exceptional man a life peerage and the title, the Right Honorable Lord Black of Cross Harbor. Lord Conrad Black, welcome to Core Principles. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for your gracious introduction. I hardly recognize myself.
Well, listeners to my program know that I have been lucky enough to speak with some really remarkable people, and even so, they're doubtless asking themselves right now, how did Clay get to talk with Lord Conrad Black? So let me acknowledge Miss Sandy Frazier, who set up this interview, and also let the audience know that a focus of today's interview is going to be about your newest book, this ambitious, massive tome called The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1, From Antiquity to the Caesars. And of course, the first obvious question, there it is, 1,200 pages approximately. The first obvious question has to be this: what motivated you to put in the overwhelming effort to write such histories?
I became convinced that it was possible to produce a meaningful and readable summary of the political development of the world. I want to emphasize you don't get all the cultural matters or all the sociology or every aspect of history. This is essentially how people govern themselves and how the units that they set up related to each other and the evolution of that throughout the period that we actually have as recorded history. I don't go other than in a number of references to the Bible in the first chapter. I don't go into folklore or legend other than where it's very well known, and I attempt to relate it as best one can to the known facts. But I became convinced that the average person would think that undertaking such a study would require them to read 20 or 30 thick volumes. And that is not the case, because if you confine it to a political and strategic history, you can, I expect 3 volumes of about 1,000 pages of text. So it's a lot of reading, but it is the whole history of the world from the period in the Old Testament where we passed from lore into authenticatable history right up to the present. And I'm 3/4 of the way through writing the second volume now. I'm up to Queen Elizabeth I in the time of Shakespeare, and I'll continue on in this volume up almost to the American Revolution, and the third volume will be the period since the American Revolution, and it's all there, and I've organized so you can read it from back to front to back, bits and pieces here and there. It's divided into plausible chapters. And my project is to make it accessible and readable and give people access to as much history as they want. And obviously, people who want to focus on particular things would then chase up specialized works in that field. But you can put it all together and make it relatively accessible to someone who's interested. And I think a huge number of people would be interested in tremendous personalities like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar and so on, if they thought they could get at them and see them in context. And it's not as daunting a task as it seems. I mean, it's not like falling off a log to write this book. But it won't be a terrible hardship to read it.
Well, you have succeeded. I confess, of course, I try to read books before I interview their authors, but no, this one is going to take me a while. I got it this week.
So do I, and we're in the minority.
But no one could undertake a project like these histories that you're writing as a solo effort. And you have a great network of colleagues and friends that you've made throughout your life. Who were some of the people that either inspired you on this journey or have provided you feedback to keep you going?
Well, the three comments on the back of the jacket are from people that would fit that category. The late Henry Kissinger, Victor Davis Hanson, I'm sure most of your listeners and viewers would be familiar with him. He's a famous American historian, classical historian, as well as a commentator on current events. And in fact, he and your former education secretary, Bill Bennett, and I have a podcast together. And the other one you mentioned was Andrew Roberts, the famous British historian, who most recently has written very, very comprehensive lives of Napoleon and of Mr. Churchill. And of course, they have had a huge number of biographies written about them, but Andrew has added a distinguished element to the shelf for both of them.
Well, I want to commend you on the way that you write these stories. They are interesting as stories. So it's not like the Cambridge histories. It's tell stories.
That's a turgid chronology. I mean, it's a very learned work, but they make no effort to achieve economy of words, and they don't make much effort to emphasize the most interesting personalities. And that's what makes history interesting, is the focus on the personalities as well as the events.
Yes, and history, I think, is generally acknowledged as one of the most vitally important subjects of study. I'm thinking about George Orwell famously writing that who controls the past controls the future, and who controls the present controls the past. And he, of course, was referring to this pernicious practice of altering stories and accounts to push a preferred view of things rather than the truth. And, you know, Donald Trump also cautioned us here in America about fake news, even in the present. So what I want to ask you, Lord Conrad Black, is how do we best guard against the altering of true history?
Well, you know, that is a terribly important question. And as you know, it's a difficult one to answer because we have to have freedom of expression. We can't deal with that by saying we will not tolerate this, for example, woke rewriting of American history that it was entirely a slave holding project and so forth. I mean, that's just rubbish. But you can't say to people, I don't have the right to say that. So I think the answer, as in so many other things, lies in promoting rigorous standards. You mentioned journalism. When I was in that business, and we had a great many newspapers, we always tried to enforce the division, the demarcation between reporting and comment. And that's almost entirely vanished from the media now. Almost every element of so-called reporting is essentially propaganda.
And commentary,
if it's in a political area. And this is, as you use your word, a pernicious practice. And but I think those of us who believe in trying to present things objectively and then agreeing that there's plenty of room for debate about the implications of historical facts, just have to insist and call everyone's attention from time to time back to the known facts. And no, it is not true that the propagation of slavery was the chief motive of the founders of the United States. That was not their chief motive. And indeed, a number of them, including Benjamin Franklin, were abolitionists, in fact. And even those who were slaveholders knew there were going to be problems with it. I mean, Jefferson said it was a fire bell in the night. Washington emancipated his slaves as well. You would never get that from the woke group. They think they were all just a bunch of slave traders. And, you know, Alexander Hamilton, who was born in the Caribbean, thought slavery was an outrage all his life. So, you know, we just have to keep enough of us reciting known historical facts and not trying to suppress debate on those facts. I mean, you can certainly argue all your life about the comparative merits of Jefferson and Hamilton, for example. That's fair comment. But saying that they were all basically a bunch of slaveholders and that was the raison d'etre of the United States is a libel on your country. It's a defamatory as well as a historically demonstrably false comment. I mean, a great, that's the one key we have here. A great deal of what you're referring to is in fact demonstrably false. And when it is false, we should say it is false, whether it's politically correct at the time or not.
And so I will say, as has been said on this program before, the 1619 Project is mostly false. Listeners, you can hearken back to an early episode of this program, listeners, with David Barton of Wall Builders. And he makes the case, he's an historian about American history primarily, that America really could be considered the most anti-slavery nation in history. But Lord Conrad Black, I want to ask you, going back to antiquity and lessons that we can learn through your histories in this volume one, what would you call out as one or two of like the most valuable lessons for modern citizens that we can understand by studying them?
I would say one thing is, from the start, it is clear that there is a requirement in the mental composition of almost everybody to think about and, if possible, adopt opinions about what we might call spiritual forces, something other than what is tangible and right in front of our eyes. And I'm not getting into religion as such, or much less presuming to comment on what anyone's religious practices or non-practices might be. That's up to every person to determine. But always, and including with the very greatest, most powerful ancient leaders like Alexander the Great, like the Caesars. Julius Caesar was nominated to the post of Pontifex Maximus at the age of 14, which shows how precocious he was. He didn't actually take the position, but it was put forward. They were religious men. Now, my point isn't that people should all go out and start worshiping. They should make up their minds whether they want to do that or not, and do it if they want to in any way they want, as long as it's not indecent or sociopathic. But we should recognize that that is a human ambition, and if we leave a vacuum there, a complete vacuum, and take the sort of anti-theistic vow that it is rubbish, there's no such thing as spiritual forces. Every day we're approaching a plenitude of knowledge. There's so much knowledge, and we're learning more every day, and eventually we'll know everything. If we're going to take that view, you're creating a vacuum, and eventually it will be filled by undesirable people to hold such power, from a comparatively innocuous Robespierre, who just presided over the Reign of Terror that killed a few thousand people, to evil, satanic, pagan monsters of our own living memories, in case of many people, such as Hitler and Stalin. And so we should recognize that that's always there, and we have to deal with it and pretend that it's just superstitious nonsense that we've now outgrown. I think a second thing is we can easily recognize that for the longest time, it was unquestioned that states would attempt to expand if they were stronger than a neighboring state or a state that was they could reach. They would try and assert themselves over it, just like beasts do. And it has taken a long time to convince a very large number of people, both by deterrence but also by a sense of values, that this is really not appropriate. We shouldn't always just be trying to conquer everybody. And that indeed was essentially the way the world was organized for most of its history. And so you had some people taking over vast masses of territory just because they had a greater military sophistication. So the Hyksos took over Egypt because they had a splendid war chariot. But they had no idea how to govern it. They had no ideas of government. And the Egyptians eventually threw them out. And we've seen this even with the Nazi takeover of France in 1940. And it was so easy, or apparently easy, because they had a technical superiority of techniques, not any other reason. And not all conquerors, but most conquerors, people like Tamerlane or Genghis Khan, they didn't contribute anything to new government. Now, that cannot be said of the Romans. The Romans set up their empire and maintained it because they cut taxes and they provided better law and order, a more peaceable environment, as well as a common market. And then they nominated the leading figures in all of these territories all around the Mediterranean and put them in the Roman Senate. So they kind of suborned their loyalties while they gave the people better government at lower tax levels. And gradually the idea of trying to not just conquer people and grind them down under the under your iron heeled jackboot, but if you want to expand, do it by governing them better and gaining their loyalty. This has been progress. I mean, one thing I do militantly insist upon is there has been very substantial progress in human perceptions of how we should govern ourselves and how we should treat other people, other groupings, you know, nationalities or states.
That's very valuable. And an observation that you offer at the conclusion of Volume 1, you say, quote, any system of governance may be made to work well by a brilliant ruler, but the litmus test is how it works under less inspired leadership. So I wanted to ask you then, what would you identify as the best political system in this era from antiquity to the advent of the Christian era? And is there a best leader you would highlight that could make it work regardless?
Yeah, I think you have to hand that prize to the Roman Empire at its height. You had that period from 96 AD to 180 AD with the so-called five good emperors: Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. There were no upheavals, no coup d'etat, skirmishing on the frontiers, but no general wars, prosperity. I mean, almost an entire century of uninterrupted peace and prosperity. And enlightened, now they were autocratic rulers, but not gratuitously authoritarian. They exercised as much authority as they needed to, but not more than was necessary, and not in a cruel or capricious way. And although as a leader, I think you get into a toss-up here, really, between Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and his grandnephew and adopted son and chosen heir, Octavian, Augustus Caesar. But as a ruler, I would have to say Augustus Caesar. It was absolutely astounding what he achieved. He governed. He was effectively the leader of the Roman world, which was the whole known world except for India and China, for 58 years, and he was almost entirely successful. But he was a perfect illustration of what you just said a minute ago, that any jurisdiction will work if it has an outstanding leader. I mean, most emperors who came after him died violently. Some of them were very good, but many of them were very unsuccessful and should never have held the job.
Yes, and we see that pattern throughout Scripture, too, in the Old Testament. Well, this king was good and this king was bad. And well, as we conclude, Lord Conrad Black, if I have a moment, can I get your insight on just a couple of quick current events? You're in Canada, right?
Yes.
And I had the opportunity to interview Tamara Leach about the Freedom Convoy. And of course, now she is being tried for the ridiculous charge of mischief. What I wanted to ask you is, how did Canadians respond to the Truckers Freedom Convoy? And what do you think is going to happen as this trial concludes for its organizers?
I know her, and she's a very admirable person, as you will have detected. I think the whole issue is settling down, and I think what will happen is either she will be acquitted or there will be no sentence, and it will be a sort of a non-event, you know. There's certainly no move nor any enthusiasm in this country to persecute her at all or do anything more. On the issue of the Truckers Convoy, you had, as you had in other countries, including in the United States, this division between those who bought into the theory that the shutdown, the compulsory masks, the compulsory vaccine, or semi-compulsory vaccine, all of that justified in public on public health grounds. But on the other side, those who were concerned about the civil liberties aspects of this, and fortunately, the controversy has largely receded because the pandemic has ended. But that's where we are, I would say.
Yes, sir. But the folks over in Davos anticipate another similar event soon. I hope they're wrong, but...
Well, they love them, though. I mean, they don't like wars, but they love public health crises because it enables them to tell everybody what to do.
Yes, sir.
One now, of I went to masters. Davos for 20 years, and while the Cold War was going on, it was a reasonably sensible place. But once the Cold War ended, our friends on the left showing a talent for improvisation I would never have credited them with suddenly crowded onto the environmental bandwagon, which at that time was occupied by legitimate conservationists and bird watchers and so on, shouldered them aside and turned it into a new battering ram with which to assault capitalism.
Yes, and so I salute that new leader from Argentina who went over there and told them, y'all are nuts. Well, finally, Donald Trump. He's the victim of lawfare right now, the 91 charges, ridiculousness. Do you have any prediction on what may come of those things? And will we Americans, in your view, choose to make America great again?
I think none of those cases, in my opinion, is going to get to a trial. I mean, none of the criminal ones, they're nonsense. I think, you know, the Georgia one is falling apart and the district attorney is probably going to be disbarred. The New York case, Bragg's case, is just rubbish. I mean, it's an attempt to conflate non-criminal acts and not even actionable acts and contort them into a crime, and it's not going to get anywhere. I doubt if it gets to trial. That leaves you with Smith. I think the whole documents thing is nonsense. The idea that Donald Trump violated the Espionage Act is foolishness. You don't hassle ex-presidents about documents. I mean, if you need to litigate, you could do it. I mean, Mr. Nixon, they stole, having made an agreement with him, they then reneged on it, the U.S. Congress did. And he and his executors sued for 25 years, and they finally won everything. Well, that's fine. Those were legitimate suits. But you don't behave as these people are doing. It is, I think what is going to happen is if he wanted an insurrection in Washington, he would have done rather better than having a bunch of lunatics with horns on their heads and swaddled in flags and so on, bumbling around in the Capitol. That wasn't an insurrection. It was a gong show. But that's not what he wanted. There were 81 million ballots sent out unasked. And millions of them were returned, not by the people whose votes they supposedly were, unverifiable, in an election where 50,000 votes had flipped in three states, he would have won. The courts refused to hear any of the constitutional arguments. Look, I'm getting this call from CBS. Could I just say I'll call him right back?
Thank you, sir.
Just give me a moment.
I think that it is going to be one of the great watersheds of the history of American democracy and the Constitution, when the dust settles and cant and emotionalism subside, and it is recognized that a much larger number of Americans are appalled at the abuse of the justice system to sandbag a political opponent, the politicization of the justice system in a way that is anti-democratic and illegal under your Constitution. More people, I think we are seeing steadily every week, are more appalled at that than they are disconcerted at the thought of a return to office by President Trump. Now, of course, there are many people who do find that disconcerting, but that number is declining. And it's not only declining, in my opinion, because the process by which his opponents are trying to block his return are unacceptable in a democracy, and not only declining because, frankly, the present administration has been unsuccessful in almost every policy area. They're declining because the Trump that the Trump haters hated isn't really there anymore. The Trump that they hated was a person whose tweets had to be walked back every day, and who was widely perceived as a boorish and obnoxious person. Now, as you kindly mentioned, I've known him for many years, and as an individual, that's not a fair description of him. A loyal friend and an extremely entertaining and likable person, as well as a very capable man. But what they are seeing now is not that person who was a caricature of the old ugly American, a kind of rich, boastful bully. The Donald Trump that is there now is someone that almost everyone can identify with. He is, though he's an ex-president and a billionaire, he is an underdog. And he's fighting against a scurrilous and outrageous abuse of the justice system being misdirected against him. And people don't like it, and they're right not to like it. And I think even his rational opponents will acknowledge that he is fighting back with great courage and admirable determination, even if they don't want him to be president. And so I think it is sorting itself out. But all of this has happened. You get this extremely controversial political personality becoming prominent at the same time that the country is going through this period of self-reexamination and overindulgence of wokeness and, frankly, American self-dislike. I think that's a reactive thing that has got quite out of control and is receding now, and it'll all sort out. But it is a difficult time because of the combination of those phenomena. I mean, I suppose those of us who don't like this woke movement would prefer that the opposition to it was led by a somewhat less abrasive figure, a sort of FDR or JFK or Ronald Reagan type. But the great office of president isn't filled by typecasting studios. And President Trump was a good president, despite the terrible conditions he operated under. And I think he will be an outstanding president on his second term.
That is such valuable insight, and I'm really thankful for it, Lord Conrad Black. It comes from Toronto, Canada, from a British citizen who is Lord of Cross Harbor, and it's right on target for this American's point of view about Donald Trump. And I think one other thing I would add is that the reason, in my view, he is doing these things as an underdog is his love of liberty and his love of the United States.
He is certainly an unambiguous patriot, and some of his opponents are not. Some of his opponents don't like the United States. They like the United States they would wish to create, but that is not a United States that most Americans want.
So valuable as well. The policy failures that you mentioned under Biden administration may not be failures at all. They may be on purpose, because the man behind the curtain said, before we elected him as President Obama, I want to fundamentally transform this nation. And a lot of us didn't want that to happen. He's still at work.
Yeah. Look, I think, yeah, these are complicated things, and nobody wants to be flippant about them. And the United States, of course, is a huge and complex country. But you're right that President Obama wished a transformation, and I think that became cross-threaded in the public mind with the widespread American view that it would be an objectively good thing to have a non-white president, to show that bigotry is receded and the progress the country has made. As you said earlier in your comment about America and slavery, no country in the history of the world has taken a formally servile minority and not just emancipated them, but attempted to assist them in becoming completely equal. No one ever did that before. And it's not been easy, and it's not quite complete. But that record is something all Americans, black, white, and others, should be proud of, and not bury it under gratuitous criticisms of the practice of slavery centuries ago, which was almost universal in the world. And I think in the abstract, it was a great thing that a non-white president was elected. I wish it had been my late friend General Colin Powell rather than President Obama. But I think Americans felt it was a step they needed to take, and in the abstract, they were right. Now, with that said, while President Obama undoubtedly is an intelligent and capable man, I did not think he was a good president.
Well, it's certainly been my honor to speak with you, Lord Conrad Black, and to gain these insights. Your experience, your knowledge, your historical perspective has added great value to me, and I'm thankful for your book. Listeners, buy Lord Black's Political and Strategic History of the World. There'll be 3 volumes. Volume 1 is now available. It's a great resource, interesting to read collection, vital stories, a lot to be learned. And so thank you again for being my guest on Core Principles, Lord Conrad Black. God bless you.
Thank you so much, Clay, and all best wishes to you and your listeners.
Core Principles podcast is produced in Paducah, Kentucky by Real Productions. Music is by Late July. LEIGHT July. You can find our music on all streaming services or at latejuly.com. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of the Core Principles Podcast. Please visit core.buzzsprout.com for more information, and please share with your friends. We look forward to visiting with you again on our next episode.